Read to you a passage here in Mark chapter 15. I think you'll understand the context. Jesus is led through the streets and he is nailed to a cross. And so in Mark chapter 15 verse 25 says this: "Now it was the third hour and they crucified him, and the inscription of his accusation was written above, 'The King of the Jews.'" We live in a very intellectual culture, and I don't know if we're the most educated culture in the history of the world. Maybe we are, maybe we aren't, but there are times when I think that we think we are. And one of the things that that means is that sometimes we think we know things that we don't. We assume that we're intelligent people and we're able to connect the dots, but sometimes we haven't fully looked into an issue. And therefore, we're speaking far beyond our intellectual capacity. And I think that's true of people speaking about religion, but also maybe more true, more specifically true, when we talk about Jesus Christ in our culture. When you ask people or when you hear people describing who Jesus is and what he's about, many will use words like he was loving and kind and gentle. And he was non-judgmental. That seems to be a word. He was accepting. And all of those things are true within the proper context. All of those things probably have to be parsed to some degree. But again, if you stop there, if you stop by talking about the meekness and love and gentleness and mercy of Jesus, you're missing a major piece of the equation, because you haven't yet accounted for how Jesus got himself crucified. See, they don't crucify people who are meek and mild and gentle and nice and non-confrontational and non-judgmental and open-minded. Those kinds of people tend not to get crucified, but Jesus got crucified. And even beyond that, for 3 years, there were plots to kill him from the very beginning of his ministry. And then if you want to go even farther, you think about all the people that Jesus preached to. I don't know what that number would be. There were times when he spoke to just one person at a time. There were other times that he spoke to as many as 15 or 20,000 people in one setting. And so you might say that he spoke to well over 100,000 people over the period of 3 years. I think that would be probably a fair assumption to say. And yet, at the very end, there's only 120 in the upper room. All have abandoned him at the point of his crucifixion. And even if you say, well, there were only 120 in the upper room, but there were a lot of others, I don't know. There's probably less than maybe 5,000 that had accepted him, but he healed a lot of people. He fed a lot of people. He taught a lot of people. And so the vast majority of people who heard him and who met him in person rejected him. Many tried to kill him. Many plotted to kill him. And so, again, when you have this image of Jesus that is painted oftentimes in 21st century America, it doesn't take into account then why people disliked him so much and the vast majority who met him in person rejected him. It doesn't explain how he was hung on a cross. And when you boil down all of the reasons why Jesus ended up on that Golgothan piece of wood, there are multiple reasons, but the big one is because of the claims he made about himself. See, again, in 21st century America, there are people who say, Jesus never claimed to be God. See, you really haven't read your Bible if you say that. I mean, you have Jesus coming to the temple, which was the house of God, and Jesus looks at the temple and says, "My house shall be called a house of prayer." He claimed to own the temple. You have Jesus saying that he is the Lord of the Sabbath. Sunday or Saturday, the Sabbath is my day, he says. You have Jesus repeatedly forgiving people of their sins. Who can forgive sins but God? You have Jesus looking at the demons and casting out demons, and the demons call him the Son of God, and he doesn't renounce them. You have Jesus looking at people and saying, if you reject me on earth, I'll deny you or I'll reject you with my Father in heaven. You have Jesus walking around claiming that he can give people eternal life. You have John chapter 8, where in a debate with the Pharisees about Abraham and the lineage of Abraham, Jesus finally, almost in frustration, says, I think in verse 59 in that chapter, he says, "Before Abraham, I am." They knew God was the great I am. And because of that, they took up stones and tried to kill him on the spot, because in that statement, he was claiming to be the I am. It was these claims that I think more than anything else brought Jesus to that cross on Golgotha. Because, see, they were claims that forced people into making a decision about him. And people in his day, as well as people in our day, would have preferred to have been on the fence. But the magnitude of the claims forced people to make a decision about him. I mean, there's decisions you can't avoid because of the magnitude of the situation. If you go to work on a job, and there you are, and you've been on the floor for 3 hours, and somebody comes up to you and says, "I want to introduce myself to you. I am the owner and founder of this company. I'm the CEO of the company. And so if anybody tells you to do anything that I didn't tell you to do, don't do it, because I'm the only one really here who can hire and fire people." I mean, you got to figure out if that guy's telling you the truth or not. I mean, you just can't blow that kind of thing off, because if he's telling you the truth, it's going to affect how you do your job. This affects everything. The magnitude of that claim has to be sort of worked out before you move forward. I mean, I hope I'm not preaching anybody's life story here, but there have been men who have, for whatever reason, woken up from an unconscious stupor married to somebody that they don't know. I mean, if you wake up and a woman is there and she says, "I'm your new wife," you sort of got to figure that one out. Because that's got to be true or false, because you potentially can lose half your stuff. You got to figure out if she's telling you the truth or not. But here's Jesus saying, "I'm your God. I'm your daddy's daddy, man. I'm the King of Kings. I'm the Lord of Lords. Whether or not you have life after this life depends on what you do with me." I mean, those claims should force anybody who is seriously intellectual into making a decision. Those are like show-stopping claims. So they were claims that sort of required a decisive decision. But see, even more than that, they were claims that required a decisive decision about submission. And see, that made them so much harder, because if Jesus is telling the truth, I mean, you got to give your life to him. You got to surrender to him. He's the God. He's the true King. And there's something inside of us that doesn't want to be told, "You're not in control. Do what I tell you to do." I mean, there's something resistant there. Augustine, in his biography, St. Augustine, the great hero of the faith, spend some time trying to figure out the question to an answer, or the answer to a question, pardon me, in his life. When he was a child, he stole some pears from a nearby vineyard or ranch. I don't know what you call a place where you grow pears. Orchard. Nearby orchard. I guess. But Augustine, reflecting on himself as a child, said it was strange, because I wasn't hungry when I stole the pears, and I don't like pears. So why would a 10 or 12-year-old steal pears when they're not hungry and they don't like pears? And reflecting as an older man, he said, the only reason I could have stole those pears was because somebody told me not to steal the pears. That was the bottom line. Somebody told me not to do it, and immediately I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I've told this story, I think, several times, but I had a teacher who was preaching in Galveston, Texas, and he was staying in one of those tall hotels that overlooked the Gulf of Mexico. And he said, I went in, and he said, I had a balcony and opened the doors, but then there was a sign there that said, no fishing off the balcony. And he said, apparently, guys were showing up now and then, and they were trying to hit the Gulf of Mexico from their balcony window, but they were miscalculating, and they had heavy-weighted sinkers, and their sinker wasn't hitting the water. It was swinging back and hitting the windows on the first floor at the restaurant. And he said, it never crossed my mind that this would be a great place to fish. But when I saw the sign, the rest of the trip, I thought, you know, that would be a good thing to do. I could fish here. See, there's a reason why the number one funeral song in England is still, I did it my way. It's what we want. We want to say, I did it my way. So here's Jesus saying, yeah, you got to make a decision about me. It's a decision of whether you're going to accept me as God or not. I mean, that really cramps the human tendency. I mean, this is why, and we've talked about it before, why I really think in this age, as our God consciousness decreases in the nation, that there's this, you know, you never lose God. Somebody takes the place of that. I mean, if you don't serve the true God, you end up serving idols. You're going to worship something. And in our culture, as our God consciousness has declined corporately, it seems like there's so many movies now about the superheroes. And I think the superheroes are taking the place of God in our thinking to some degree. And I think the superheroes are our man-made gods, so to speak. And why we like superheroes is this. They save us, but they don't rule us. You shine the light, tell Batman you need help down in Gotham City? He comes down, he fixes the problem, he goes back up to the Batcave and drinks coffee till you call him again. Superman's the same way. He saves you, he goes back, and then he acts like he's Clark Kent. That they save you, but they don't rule you. That's what we really want. But then here's Jesus, and he's saying, see, but I'm God, the King of Kings, I'm the Lord of Lords, and I can save you, yes, but I haven't came to save you, I've come to rule too. And that's what got Jesus put on the cross. That's what got him rejected, or had him rejected, by probably well over 90% of the people who ever met him. And it's a problem for you and I today in this culture. The decision is still there. Here's Jesus saying, Son of God, God incarnate, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, you got to make a decision about me. And the decision is just not whether you like me or vote for me or find me attractive. The decision is whether I'm going to be your God and your King. Now, what's interesting, and you know this, is that in spite of the human tendency to not want to be ruled, in spite of our repulsion when somebody says, I'm your God, something in there that doesn't like that, many, many people have accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. The question is why? I mean, not everybody rejected Jesus. Some accepted him. Not everybody was standing there assenting to his crucifixion. Some looked at that banner, King of the Jews, and they said, that's absolutely right. They didn't mean to put that up there as a statement of truth, but it is the truth. They put it up there to mock him, but it's true. He's not only the King of the Jews, he's my King too. People have done that. And you say, well, why? And at the surface, you could say, well, it's because They've examined who Jesus is, and they have found his claims to be true. They've looked at Jesus, and they've said, you know what? There is something special, something very unique about him. I mean, the old saying is, I think, still true. God didn't send us an ironclad argument. He sent us an ironclad person. You look at Jesus, and you look at him, and you come to the conclusion that Pilate came to. I find no fault in this man. What's the problem with this man? I mean, he's not crazy, and he's not a devil. I mean, everybody else who claimed to be God were bat crazy or demonic. But Jesus isn't crazy, and he's not demonic. You know, I find it hard to find a flaw in him. Of course, others, and we'll talk maybe about that next week, I don't know. Others look at the resurrection and say, you know what, whatever you say, I can't get around the resurrection. I mean, the Romans wanted him in the tomb. The Jews wanted him in the tomb. His followers might have wanted him out of the tomb, but then everywhere they went the rest of their life, they got beat up and ultimately killed because they said he was resurrected. They had no earthly incentive to say he was resurrected because every time they did, something bad happened to them. So really, in one sense, nobody set out to have him resurrected. Jews and the Romans didn't want him out of the grave, and the disciples were basically killed because they wouldn't renounce that he hadn't risen. I mean, the resurrection's harder to disprove than you might think, I'm trying to say. So there are people who have looked at the evidence and said, well, he is who he says he is. But then again, that can't be why people have surrendered to him entirely. Because there are a lot of people, even in America, who would say, I believe Jesus is the Son of God, but they haven't surrendered their lives to him. I mean, they know who Jesus is. They don't have issues with that. They believe in the resurrection. They'll be at church next Sunday celebrating the resurrection, but they haven't given their lives to him. They still listen to what they want to listen to and watch what they want to watch and sleep with who they want to sleep with and shack with who they want to shack with and gossip about who they want to gossip with and yell at who they want to yell at. And I mean, they're still very much in control of their lives. Although on the surface, they would say, well, I believe that Jesus is who he said he was. So then again, why do people give their lives to Jesus? I think some people do it for intellectual reasons. I mean, there are, I think, people who think through the process and say, listen, and these are, I think, people, I think, who know their heart. They say, everybody's got a king. I mean, everybody's got a king. I mean, everybody's controlled by something. I mean, how many people even in the world don't have somebody that they answer to? And even people who think they're not controlled, when they really look at it, they are being controlled. You know, it's interesting when you look at people in Hollywood, there's probably nobody who lives more libertine lives than the Hollywood crowd. I mean, they put whatever they want to in their body and have any kind of relationship that they want. I mean, they are a lawless bunch, morally in many ways. But of course, when all the information came out about, like, Harvey Weinstein, what you found out was all those people who lived without rules were controlled by Harvey Weinstein because he controlled their careers. I mean, you look at the mobsters, and the mobsters, they'll kill anybody they want to, but there's still a Don telling them what to do. I mean, even when you look at people who seem to live without rules and live the life that they want to without controls, there's usually always somebody calling the shots. It's not a person, it's a drug, it's a fear, it's an anxiety. And there are people, I think, who just intellectually say, listen, I'm going to have a king anyway. Why not let it be King Jesus? Somebody's going to be in control. Instead of all the fear, instead of all the anxiety, instead of the drugs, instead of the words of the people that I want to please, I might as well just give myself to King Jesus. And if you think that way, you're a smart person. It's a smart way to think. So I think some work through an intellectual process and they get there. I think others have an experiential process. That is to say that somewhere in life they meet Jesus. Maybe in the darkest place in their life, sitting in a hotel room contemplating their future, they open the Gideon Bible and they can't explain what happens, but it seems like Jesus shows up. Experience Him. I mean, it's almost as though they're like the three Hebrew children in the fiery furnace, and in their furnace, a fourth man shows up. And they can't explain it, and they couldn't predict it, but there they are at the bottom point of the divorce, or there they are at the hospital, in the hospital room, or there they are at the grave, or maybe it's not in the valley, maybe it's on the mountain, maybe they've experienced something wonderful, and as they gaze out over the mountain, look into the valley, something whispers in the air, or somebody who says, "You know who created all this, don't you?" But somewhere along the way, they and it's never easy to put into words the experience, but they would say, "I experienced Jesus. Found Him. He came to me in that jail cell. There He was. There was Jesus." I think even more come to Jesus, not because they've thought their way there, maybe not even because they can say, "You know, I heard the words of Jesus. He was there in the room." I think maybe even more come to Jesus because they're just hopeless. I think that's what was happening when Jesus lived. The sick would line up, and I don't know how much thought they had done. They were sick, and there was a chance Jesus could save them and heal them. They lined the streets. I think most of the people who came and heard Jesus, some of them probably had intellectual reasons, but there was just a sense of desperation in them. I don't even know how much faith they had. But I heard a preacher say once, and he was a brilliant man, he said, "When you look at the Bible, it seems like more people got saved by Jesus out of desperation than faith." When you look at those people who came to Jesus again, you say, "Well, they all had faith." I don't know how much they knew. I don't know. I bet they had less faith and knew less than you know. They just had desperation. It was broken. They were hurting. They hadn't seen an angel and experienced the warming of their heart. But they said, "I got to have help. I need help." And if Jesus is who He says He is, He can help me. Because I know the doctors can't. I know the therapists can't. I've gone and talked to the preacher 3 times. He doesn't seem to be able to help me. I know my parents can't. I know my friends can't. Maybe Jesus can help me. Truth of the matter is even though most of the people in the world continues to reject Him, there are people who do find Him, and their lives are changed. He infuses us with hope. He turns our lives around. And I wish I could say it in a way that you would believe me. But Jesus is the greatest thing in the world. There's nothing more beautiful than Him. There's nothing more wonderful than Him. There's nothing that will give you more confidence than knowing that you have favor with Jesus Christ. Nothing. I was thinking this today. Stand with me. You'll encourage me to quit. I was thinking about Martin Luther. And Martin Luther made everybody mad. Martin Luther 500 years ago. He ticked off the whole Catholic Church, and they had the power of life and death 500 years ago. And they said, Martin Luther, you come to Worms and you give an account for yourself. And every friend of Martin Luther said, don't go, because all the powers of hell await you in Worms. Martin Luther said, yeah, but in Worms, Jesus still reigns. Amen. I mean, you get Jesus. You get into the kingdom of Jesus. When he starts to reign in your life, and you know that really he reigns throughout the world and throughout eternity, and you start to walk a different way, you start to think a different way. I like this place in Numbers chapter 22 through 24. There's a lot of comedy there. But Balak is the king of Moab, and he wants Balaam, the crooked prophet, to curse the children of Israel. Put a curse on them so I can win. Of course, you got the talking donkey in that text and all that. But finally, Balaam goes to the mountain, and he's looking over into the valley where the Israelites are encamped. And he essentially says, I can't curse them because there's the shout of the king in the camp. He said, I can't mess with them. There's the presence of a king down in there. I can't mess with the king. I want you to know today that there is a king, and his name is King Jesus. When all the kingdoms of the world have been destroyed and everything is rubble, he'll still be king. You ought to accept him as king. It is intellectually dishonest to continue to go on with life and say, oh, he's a nice person. No, he's a devil, he's crazy, or he's God. Those are your options. And don't wait till you get to your deathbed to figure that out. It matters how you live your life today. I wonder today if those of you who have already accepted King Jesus would like to come, maybe worship him today. You worship this king because he's God. Maybe you have a prayer. What did John Newton say? He said something to the fact of, you're coming to a king with the large petitions bring. I missed a part. But he's a great king. He's a wealthy king. And Newton is saying, when you come, come and ask big. Come and ask big. He's a great king. I'm talking to you again who have not accepted this king. Today's your day. Today's your day.